Well, good evening to every one of you. What a joy it is to be with you tonight, as well as the past 3 days. This has really been a double enjoyment. I've enjoyed being with this fine and lovely congregation and getting to stay with Phil and Rebecca. Phil has not felt well this week, so he hasn't been able to come. But she continues to be my darling daughter, just as she's been for more than 60 years now. A few words of gratitude are in order. First of all, I appreciate Brother Garland for recommending me for this meeting and the elders for inviting me to come. I appreciate all the warm words of encouragement that you've given me. I certainly appreciate the attentive way that you have listened to all of the remarks that have been made. I appreciate those who have led the singing and those of you who have responded so well, those who have led our prayers. And everything has been such a joy in being with you. I appreciate those of you that have bought one or more of my books or tracts. Brother Garland knows something about the cost of putting out printed material, and just about everything that you and I buy goes one direction, and that's the way with publishing costs in our day. But thank you so much for every kindness that you have rendered to me. I meant to tell this little story last night, right before we sang the song Softly and Tenderly. Will Thompson is the one who wrote that song. It's one of my favorite, if not my favorite, invitation song in all that we sing from the end of the services. But according to this little story, Dwight Moody, who was internationally known as a preacher, he and Will met near the end of Dwight's life. And he said something like this to Will. He said, "Will, I would rather have written the words and the music of Softly and Tenderly than anything else I've done in all of my life." Well, that was a tribute to the beauty of this song. And there's so many beautiful songs that we sing, and they ought to be treasured, spiritual treasures to every one of us. Now for our last 6 chapters in the wonderful book of Acts, written by Luke, the beloved physician, as Paul referred to him in Colossians, the 4th chapter. It falls into 2 major divisions, the first 12 chapters and the last 16 chapters. And by the way, the chapters that we studied tonight, one of the songs that we have sung tonight, "Do All in the Name of the Lord." And Paul, in Colossians 3 and verse 17, told the Colossian people to do that. And Paul wrote this statement in the very area of time that we are going to be talking about tonight. A number of his epistles were written while he was in prison during this part of his grand and great and glorious life. Acts, the 23rd chapter. Paul begins it by affirming that he had lived in all good conscience before God until this day. We might raise a few questions about that. We might say, was he doing it in good conscience when he presided at the stoning of Stephen, when he consented to the death of Stephen, when he made havoc of the church, when he entered into every house arresting men and women, committing them to prison, or when he put to death a number of Christians when it was in his power to do so? Well, I think we'd say yes to all of that. But a good conscience does not necessarily guarantee proper conduct. And that's valuable for us to see and fully accept. He believed he was doing the right thing in persecuting Christ and the disciple. I believe that what he did is really a fulfillment of what Jesus stated in the great sermon in the upper room. In John the 16th chapter, he told the disciples that the day will come when people will put you to death and they will think that they're doing service to God as a result. Paul certainly fits that in Acts 8, and the first part of Acts 9. And then the high priest Ananias. There are some commentators who take the view, and I think they're right in this, that this Ananias really was not a legal high priest, that he was a usurper to that. And instead of being in the direct lineage of Aaron, the first high priest, he was not a part of that lineage at all. And later on, he will be assassinated. He was a rather corrupt kind of individual. And he's the one that lashed out at Paul and had him smitten. And Paul stated in response, "You claim to judge me by the law. You smite me contrary to what the law demands." And so Paul really did not apologize. He knew the history of this man. He knew that what he said was in proper order. Remember, he's an inspired man, and Jesus had promised the apostles that they would be given the say, or the proper words to pronounce, when they were before civil authorities, as he was before a religious authority at this time. The three men in the book of Acts that go by the name of Ananias, there is Ananias that's connected with Sapphira in Acts, the 5th chapter. And then there is this Ananias here in Acts, the 23rd chapter. And then there is the Ananias that came to Paul, a very faithful man, and one who helped the Apostle Paul to complete his obedience to the gospel. There are marked differences between two of these Ananiases and the one that we read about in helping the Apostle Paul. Ananias, a man who enjoyed a good report among all the Jews in Damascus. And then Paul detected that in this audience, he has Pharisees present, he has Sadducees present. And Paul made the statement to his audience, "I am a Pharisee, the son of a Pharisee, of the hope and resurrection of the dead. I'm called in question this day." I don't believe Paul is suggesting that in religion, I am now a Pharisee, a traditionalist. That was a part of his past, and it had been given up at the time of his conversion. But as far as a belief in the resurrection, as far as a belief that man has a soul, as far as belief that the angels actually exist in heaven, he subscribed to them just as the Pharisees did. But the Sadducees were far different. In fact, they tried to trip the Lord up on whose wife shall she be in the resurrection or in the heavenly world in Matthew, the 22nd chapter. They did not believe there would be a heaven. They did not believe there would be a resurrection. They did not believe there would be any kind of life after this one comes to a close. They were the modernists, they were the liberals, they were the materialists of the first century. And soon there develops a controversy between the Pharisees on the one hand and the Sadducees on the other hand. And Paul, for a little while, kind of fades in the background as they bring up their arguments with each other, and it becomes rather heated at the time. And it seemed as though Paul's life is in danger again. And so the chief captain, as he's already done in the past, sees to it that Paul is going to be made safe. And then we read something about 40 Jews, more than 40 Jews, who had entered into a covenant, into an oath, and they say to the Jewish authorities, "We, 40 men plus, have entered into an agreement that we're not going to eat anything, we're not going to drink anything until we have killed the Apostle Paul." They didn't actually call him the Apostle. But they suggested to the Jewish authorities, "You have the chief captain bring him down as though we would try him more thoroughly. And as soon as he's on his way, we will waylay him, we will assassinate him before he comes before the group." That's the kind of men these 40 men were. Well, Paul's nephew, and this is the only time in the New Testament that we read about this young man, but he heard what these 40 men were planning to do. And he immediately went to the Apostle Paul and told him about the danger in which he was to be found. And Paul suggested you go to the chief captain and tell him what you've told me. And that's exactly what he did. And upon learning this, the chief captain did some things that were really, really honorable. Now, there's some fault and flaws in this man's life, as I'll point out in a moment or two, but here he acted honorably. He went into action immediately. He did not wait a few days before trying to do something. Immediately, he called together 470 soldiers or military men and had beasts to be a part of that and to take the Apostle Paul to Caesarea for safekeeping. And 400 of these accompanied him half the way. They returned back to Jerusalem, that is, the soldiers and the spearmen, and then the horsemen or the cavalry went on with Paul to the city of Caesarea. There they came in contact with a governor, a man by the name of Felix, and we'll have more to say about him in Acts, the 24th chapter. But Paul is presented in the courtroom or in the presence of Felix. Felix asked him to what area he belonged, and when he learned that he was from Cilicia, he said, "When the chief captain comes down, I will be in a position to know more about this order." And he kept Paul in prison at this time. The Bible tells us in regard to Felix that he was a very corrupt man. But now let's look at Paul in Acts, the 24th chapter. In Acts, the 24th chapter, we find a group of Jewish rulers made the trip to Caesarea in order that they might kill the Apostle Paul. They suggested that he be sent, and they hoped to waylay him on the way. But he's at Caesarea, where he would be kept for the next 2 years. And it just shows that they were determined that they were going to kill the Apostle Paul. Well, they come and lay their case against Paul in Acts, the 24th chapter. They include him of being a pestilent fellow, of being a ringleader of the Nazarenes, as being a person who had created sedition among all the Jews in the whole world. Not a single one of these accusations enjoyed a syllable of truth. Every single one of them was flawed. Every single one of them was false to the very core. After they had presented their course, and it was one in which they had not proved themselves or their case at all, then the Apostle Paul is given his say. He said, "I'm glad to present this before Felix." He recognized that Felix had been governor for some time, and he knew quite a little about Jewish culture and Jewish law and Jewish custom. And so Paul was glad to present his case before Felix. He presented several things about why these allusions or why these accusations were not true. He said, "It's only been 12 days since I went to Jerusalem, and nobody found me in the temple. Nobody found me in any Jewish synagogue. Nobody found me anywhere in the Jerusalem area creating any kind of trouble, any kind of disturbance." But he also announced that he, as one person, still believed in the resurrection of the dead, and of the hope of that resurrection, his life was often placed in danger, especially by the Sadducean people. And then a little bit later on, we find that Felix and Drusilla have the Apostle Paul come and preach to them. A little something about Drusilla: she belonged to the Herodian family. She was the great-granddaughter of Herod the Great, the one who sought to kill Jesus at the time of his birth, Matthew the 2nd chapter. She also was the great-niece of Herod Antipas, the one that had put John the Baptist to death, having him beheaded. She was the daughter of the Herod Agrippa the 1st, who had put James to death way back in Acts, the 12th chapter. She also was a sister to King Agrippa the First, and then to Bernice. And so she belonged to a rather infamous family, a very wicked group of people. There's not much that can be said in regard to this family as far as righteousness and holiness are concerned. But the Apostle Paul has, I'm sure it must have been a pleasure and perhaps a deep delight and maybe even a surprise when Drusilla and Felix come and he has the opportunity of preaching to them. Now remember, he's talking to a pagan couple. He's talking to an irreligious couple. He's talking to a couple that were living in adultery. Drusilla had already been married before, and Felix succeeded in seducing her and making it his wife. So they were living in open and notorious adultery at this time. Paul decided he was going to talk to them about righteousness, that he was going to talk to them about temperance or self-control, that he was going to portray before them the judgment to come. Remember, righteousness is right doing. It's right thinking, it's right speaking, it's right acting. And that's exactly what they needed, because their lives had not been filled with any degree of righteousness. Their lives had been filled with infamy, their lives had been filled with wickedness, their lives had been filled with much in the way of immorality. They needed to hear a lesson about righteousness. And then we have temperance or self-control. These two people were not exercising control by entering into an adulterous marriage. That's a sure sign that they were not aware of what they ought to be doing in self-control. And then, as far as the judgment is concerned, they were not ready in any sense of the term to die and ultimately face God and Christ in the coming judgment day. In fact, no doubt Paul made this just as colorful and just as plain as he could as he talked to this couple about the judgment to come. Luke tells us that Felix trembled. We do not have any word about Drusilla's response to this. But Paul had said something in his message that he had come to Jerusalem sometime earlier, and he had brought a contribution for the people, the poor people in that area. And I think there's an interesting point here that I think many of our brethren have missed entirely. You are acquainted, no doubt, with the so-called saint-only doctrine that from the church treasury, nobody can be fed, nobody can be helped, nobody can receive any kind of aid unless he's a member or she's a member of the church. It's a selfish kind of doctrine from the very word. But when Paul said he came to the area in order to bring alms to his nation, and the word for nation there is the very same word that Felix ruled over. And so Paul, I'm sure, brought money and brought help for those who were poor, the saints who were poor, as well as people outside the church. What finer way of influencing people than to help them in a time of need? Benevolence, I think, goes hand in hand with conversion. Many times we can help people in a physical sort of way, and when they're facing illnesses, when they're facing hardship, maybe only to open the door for later teaching them the gospel of the Son of God. Many people are Christians today because they've gone through that very process. But this is something that caught the ear of Felix, that idea of arm. And so he kept Paul in custody for the next 2 years, and during that time, he will write some of his prison epistles, Colossians being one of them, as I've already mentioned. In fact, Felix had the hope that Paul would raise some funds from among his friends to bribe him, and he would then let Paul go free. Well, this brings us to Acts, the 25th chapter. At the end of chapter 24, Felix loses his position as the governor, and the new governor is going to be Festus. Now, Felix knew a lot more about the Jewish religion, the Jewish culture, and the Jewish law system than Festus did. Festus did not know much about the new people over which he had been placed as governor. But he was not in office long at all until these Jews, it had been 2 years now since they first accused him before Felix, they had not lost any of their hatred. They had not lost any of their determination that they were going to kill this man that they hated with the deepest of disdain. And so they immediately suggest to Festus, will you have the Apostle Paul, they didn't call him that, will you have Paul to be brought from Caesarea to Jerusalem in order that he might be before us? Well, they didn't have any idea of getting him to Jerusalem. They fully intended to kill him somewhere on the way. And of course, it's several miles from Caesarea, traveling in a southern, southeastern direction to the city of Jerusalem. And Festus refused that. That was honorable upon his part. He suggested that in just a short time, I'll be going to Caesarea, and those of you who have anything against this man, you can come and I'll bring him before the judgment seat and you can have your case against him. Well, they didn't waste any time about that. Festus stayed in Jerusalem for a few days and then he went to the city of Caesarea. Caesarea in that day was the headquarters of the Roman governors. By the way, Caesarea, about 60 years before this, had been built by Herod the Great. And so it's a fairly new city in New Testament time. And the remains of it are seen by tourists that visit Palestine today. I visited the area when I was in Bible Land several years ago. But they laid basically the same case against Paul that they had done in the presence of Felix. And it appeared to Paul that he was not going to receive any kind of justice in Palestine. And remember, he's a Roman citizen. He had not bought his citizenship, as Lysias, the chief captain, had done. He was born as a Roman citizen, meaning that his father and mother were Roman citizen as he was born and grew up in Cilicia. And he had the right to make an appeal to Caesar. And when Festus said, would you go to Jerusalem and there appear before me? And he said, no, I'm not going to go. I appeal to Caesar. And Festus did not have any much of anything to say in opposition to this because he had that right. And so Festus determined that he was going to send him to Caesar. This would be Nero Caesar. He was on the throne of the emperor in the city of Rome at the present time. He was one of the most wicked, one of the vilest men that ever lived. Even had his mother killed. He didn't have any morals and ethics about him. They tell the story that when Rome was burning, he was fiddling during the time. That shows the kind of character, low character, that he really, really was. But Caesar will be the one that Paul has to appeal to. Provisions are made for Paul to go to the city of Rome. But Festus really did not have anything to write about. Here's a man that he knew had not done anything worthy of death, a man that was totally innocent of the charges that the Jewish people had made against him, and yet he was supposed to write out something for the emperor to read, suggesting why he's being sent all the way from Palestine, all the way to Rome. And in the meantime, Bernice and her brother Agrippa, this is Herod Agrippa II, the one that we'll talk about in the next chapter, they come and make a visit. And they stay with Festus for a few days. And while there, Festus sets forth Paul's case and told the king what dilemma he was facing. And the king said, I would like to hear the man myself. And that's exactly what Festus wanted him to say. And so on a set day, Festus and King Agrippa and Bernice and other principal men in the city of Caesarea came together, and Paul is brought before them. Festus tells briefly to the king why he has brought Paul into his presence and wanted him to help him in writing something to his lord, the Augustus Caesar. And that brings us to Acts, the 26th chapter. This is a chapter in which Jesus deals with King Agrippa. Maybe I get a drink of water. Yeah. Also in this chapter, Paul gives the third account of his conversion. He had done so in Acts, the 9th chapter. That was Luke's account of the event. He does so in Acts, the 22nd chapter, which he has already done in a previous lesson. And then he has his say before King Agrippa about his conversion. He referred briefly to his history and the religious conviction that he had. He talked about the conversion that had turned him away from being a persecutor. In fact, in Acts, the 26th chapter, he mentioned some of the crimes that he had committed against the Christians of that day. And then continuing on, he suggested to the king that I was not disobedient to that vision. A vision had appeared to Paul, or Saul, as he was known then. He had seen a bright light, and Acts, the 26th chapter, tells us that that light was brighter than the noonday sun. And instructions were given as to what he ought to do, and he says to the king, I was not disobedient to the heavenly vision. And if Agrippa is following him closely, he should have been willing to say, well, Paul, you shouldn't have resisted that. You should have been obedient to the call that was given to you. But Paul outlined some of the things that he had done after he obeyed the gospel, how he had preached the gospel of repentance, how he had preached both to Jew and Gentile, how that he was willing to suffer in behalf of the truth. And then in the latter part of Acts, the 26th chapter, as Paul was speaking for himself, Festus cried with a loud voice, Paul, thou art beside thyself. Much learning doth make thee mad. But he said, I am not mad, most noble Festus, but speak forth the words of truth and soberness. For the king knoweth of the things for which I speak, for I am persuaded that these things were not hidden from him, for this thing was not done in a corner. And then Paul is rather plain when he says, King Agrippa, believest thou the truth? I know that thou believest. And Agrippa is reported by Luke to say, almost thou persuadest me to be a Christian. Now there are a number of commentators on this verse who say that Agrippa was saying this in a sarcastic way, that he was not really sincere at all. I never have accepted that position, because I believe that Paul shed some lights on this when he said, I would, O God, that not only thou, but also all that hear me this day were both almost and altogether such as I am, except these bonds. And so I believe that Paul, and he's an inspired man, a very brilliant man, a very observing man, and I believe that he thought the king was sincere. And notice that Paul wanted him to be, as well as all the audience, exactly what Paul was. And he made one exception. I would wish Roman bonds upon no man. I heard Brother Fred Chun, he was one of our great preachers in West Tennessee, preach a lesson, I guess, sometime in the 1960s. And he called the lesson A Christian Just Like Paul. And he used this as his text. And I copied down some of the notes that I took from him that night, and later worked up a sermon that has become one of my all-time favorites, namely A Christian Just Like Paul. And some of the points that I make in that lesson, and they are that Paul, that Paul was a Christian in fact. He was a Christian in name. He was a Christian on location. He was a Christian in suffering. He was a Christian in distress and all kinds of trouble. He was a Christian to the very end. He was a Christian through and through. No insincerity about the Apostle Paul at all. But this brings us to the end of Acts 26. And after Paul had finished his discourse, his defense, they decide, or they suggest among themselves, that if Paul had not appealed to Caesar, he might have been set free. That was the response that King Agrippa gave to this situation. But now in Acts, the 27th chapter, we have the long voyage all the way from Palestinian coastline at Caesarea to far off Rome in the distant west. And the shipping was fairly safe and without much difficulty in the first part of the journey. They left Caesarea, they traveled north for a little while, and then they traveled close to the island of Cyprus and on to the island of Crete. And there was a place in the island of Crete where Paul suggested this would be the best place for us to spend the winter. We know for a surety that he said this sometime in October or sometimes in November. I say that because Luke mentions that the fast was already passed. And by the fast, he's referring to the Day of Atonement, the seventh month and the 10th day. Well, the seventh month and the 10th day with us would be July the 10th, but it was not to the Jewish people. They counted their year beginning a little bit later than we do. And so the seventh month would be during October or November. And so it was sometime in the early part of the fall or the autumn when they were making this trip. Paul had often traveled upon the Mediterranean Sea as well as upon the Aegean Sea. He was skilled as far as sailing and avoiding danger. He said to the ones who controlled the ship, and there were 276 persons of all of them, he said, "I believe that if we leave this and try to make another harbor, I believe it will be to our loss, the loss of the ship, and maybe a loss to our own life." But the owner of the ship decided to listen to the majority, and he said, "This is not a good place for us to stay." And so they decided to travel a little bit further on and find a place that would be more suitable for winter stay. And that was bad advice on the part of the majority of the people. Because soon after they embarked on the last leg of that trip, they ran into a vicious storm, a storm at sea called Euroclydon. And the ship began to face all kinds of difficulty. Remember, they're not steam-powered as our ships have been in more recent time. They depended upon the sails, and they could be swept this way or that way. And it became so bad during this trip that at times they would throw out some of the things on the ship to make the ship a little bit lighter. There was a period when they were facing great difficulty, and the sailors, now there were sailors on board the ship, and there were soldiers on the ship. And it appeared one night that the sailors were going to take the lifeboat and put it into the water, and they were going to leave the larger ship, and they were to go off in the lifeboat. Paul suggested, "Except these be retained here, ye cannot be saved." Some people, I think, have misquoted that passage. Paul did not say, "Except you stay in the ship, you cannot be saved." He's talking about the staying of the sailors. "Except they stay in the ship, then soldiers are not going to escape either." And so they cut the lifeboat off, and the sailors remain. Ultimately, they come close to the island of Melita or Melita. And the storm is still bruising. They finally manage to have the ship into the harbor. It stuck fast as far as the front part of the ship was concerned. The latter part of the ship was practically destroyed. And so, and so the soldier said to the chief captain, "I think we ought to kill our prisoners lest they escape the situation." And the centurion says, "No, we're not going to kill any of the prisoners at all." And it seems to me that this is a case of unrequited love. I often preach a sermon on this and go through the Bible and talk about cases where one person loves and befriends another, and that person does not return that favor at all. That can be in marriage, it can be in church relationship, it can be in work or ethical relationship, but many people practice unrequited love, and they are the victims of unrequited love. I think that's true upon this occasion, because Paul was the reason why these soldiers were not going to die. He's the reason they were going to be saved without the loss of a one. And yet they pay him back by suggesting that he and the others be killed. By the way, Luke is with him on that journey, and Aristarchus is with him on that journey. So far as we know, they were the three Christians on board with the others that made up the list of people on the board. Then they all escaped. Some were able to swim, and so they swam to the shore of the little island. Others, not able to swim, they would pick pieces of boards from the ship, and finally all of them made their way to the shore. And this is a beautiful picture that we have in Acts, the 28th chapter, because the people on this little island received them graciously. And it was a cold day, and it was a disagreeable day. The rain had been coming down. They were drenched with water, and the islanders made a little fire for them to warm by. And Paul, always one to do his part, he picked up a bundle of sticks, intending to throw it on the fire that was already kindled. And there was a venom. There was a viper, some kind of poisonous snake or serpent that bit him in the hand or on the arm. And when the islanders saw that, they said, "Surely this man, even though has escaped the sea, nevertheless, justice is going to call and make him a dead person." But when he shook it off without any harm, they changed their minds and said, "He is a god." Well, he wasn't God, he was a man, but a very good man, a very miraculously endowed man. And as news spread about their stay here on the island, Paul healed the father of Publius, the chief man on the island. And when news of this began to spread abroad, all the ones who had serious cases of diseases were brought to Paul, and he was able to heal them. Mention seems to be the impression, or at least I get the impression here, that Paul provided them miraculously, and maybe Luke, being the beloved physician that he was, offered his medical skill in helping, because miracles were involved only when human help was not able to do the job and complete it. Well, the islanders furnished them with the things that they needed, and when it came time for them to leave, they traveled in a northern direction up around Sicily, the boot of Italy, always with the destination of Rome in mind. Finally, in this chapter, they come to Rome, and the prisoners are delivered to where they were to be kept, and Paul has his own quarters, and he's able to stay there. He hadn't been in the city of Rome very long until he called the Jewish leaders and wanted to have a conference with them or a conversation with them. And he told them briefly why he was there, that he had been accused and he had appealed to Caesar. But he said, "I had not committed anything worthy of death or worthy of being arrested or worthy of being a prisoner." And the people with whom he's speaking said, "We did not receive anything adverse about you, The ones who came from Palestine to Rome had nothing to say by way of a derogatory attitude toward you. And so Paul was speaking to people that were not engulfed in prejudice. And so he preached to these people, and they had told him, even before he began to preach really effectively, that we desire to hear what you think, because this sect to which you belong is spoken of against, and we want to know what your thinking is. And that's all that the Apostle Paul needed. He preached to them about the kingdom of God. He preached to them about the gospel. He preached to them about the salvation of the soul. He preached to them about everything that's necessary to go home to heaven. It must have been a wonderful sermon, and it wasn't a sermonette. It didn't close at 30 minutes or 40 minutes or an hour. It was an all-day sermon that he presented to these people, a morning sermon, and then extending it through the afternoon. And so Paul has now reached the place where Acts 28 ends. He has his own living quarters. He's able to receive those who come to him. He is able to do a great work while he's there in the city of Rome. In fact, during this period of time, he will write some of his great epistles. Probably he had already written 1st and 2nd Thessalonians long before this, perhaps 1st and 2nd Corinthians, and maybe Galatians, no doubt Galatians, maybe Romans. But the prison epistles were Ephesians and Philippians and Colossians and Philemon, and Paul penned those while he was in prison. There's some controversy about whether he was released at the end of the 2 years, but I'm convinced that when we note some of the things that were written by him later, that he was released, that he was able to move around and visit the churches and help people in the latter part of his life. And then after that, he is arrested again. He is brought to Rome the second time. No longer is he permitted to have his own living quarters. Now he's placed in the old Mamertine dungeon, an underground prison, very uncomfortable. And remember, this is about winter time when he is there. That's about the time when they arrived in Rome. And so he needed some help as far as clothing was concerned. And so when he wrote, he told Timothy, "When you come, bring the cloak that I left at Carpus." And so he needed that cloak. And how we would have delighted if we could have been there, of supplying him with all of the clothing, all of the food, all of the care, all of the love, all of the interest that we possibly could. That's the attitude that we have toward Paul, because he, along with Peter, the two main personalities throughout this whole book, they loved the Lord, and we love the Lord. They served the Lord, and we serve the Lord. They wanted to go to home to heaven, and we want to go home to heaven. And Paul and Peter have done so much in writing the very material that we need in order to become informed and reformed from a life of sin and error, and then a life prepared for heaven at last. If you're here tonight and have never obeyed the gospel, to become a Christian, it is necessary to hear, not just hear anything and everything, but hear the truth and believe from the heart that Jesus Christ is the Son of God. Peter made that good confession in Matthew 16:16. "Thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God." We are to repent. Jesus said it's either repent or perish. Quite literally, change or else you'll be punished eternally. And then we're to make the good confession, the one that the eunuch did. "I believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God," and then be baptized for the remission of sin. If you've done this and need to return to the Savior, maybe becoming unfaithful, then God has a second law of pardon, namely walking the route of repentance, confession, and prayer. If subject to either, we encourage you to come as we stand and sing.